this is Kelly from the Peak Publication Society, SFU student-led newspaper. Recently, news organizations have been facing issues sharing news content. All news outlets, including small publications like us, have been affected due to Meta's refusal to comply with the Online News Act and compensate news companies. We have been serving our diverse student community for years and need your support to continue. If you'd like to contribute as a paid writer, illustrator, or photographer, follow us on Instagram at @thepeak@SFU. Keep reading our stories at the-peak.ca. If Meta is listening, we're just a community promoting SFU events. Please don't block us again.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Brandon, and I am joined today by Hale. Today, we are going to be reading through one of the speeches of Plato's Symposium. Specifically, we're going to be reading through Agathon's speech, which is nestled right in the middle of the dialogue. And we're going to be reading it for a particular reason. We're kind of reading that speech as one way into exploring rhetoric and rhetoric in relation to philosophy. I don't want to say too much about that relation just yet, but essentially, just to introduce the subject, rhetoric is the art of speech, the art of speech making, the art of persuasion, and the art of conviction. Philosophy's relationship with rhetoric, it has a storied history. It goes quite far back, as Plato is treating it here, and even farther back in his earlier dialogues, and even the way that some of the pre-Socratic philosophers make decisions and how they expound and write, or even don't write, their own philosophy. So since we are getting into Plato's Symposium, and we're jumping into this speech as kind of a vehicle for exploring rhetoric, but just to get us up to speed so we know what is going on in this dialogue if you haven't encountered Plato's Symposium before, just to set the stage. Plato's Symposium is set at a symposium, which is a formal drinking party. Plato's Symposium is set in a symposium, which is the Greek term for a formal drinking party. There were rites and customs for this. And they are celebrating a tragedian's victory at a tragedy competition. It's also set at his house. And in fact, the winner of the tragedy competition is the person who is going to be delivering this speech. This is Agathon's speech. But before we get to Agathon's speech, it's not about him celebrating his victory. What everyone is doing at the symposium is they are singing or reciting hymns to Eros, the god of love. And the first speech is given by Pausanias, and I won't go into too much detail about them, but essentially the points are that for Pausanias, he makes a distinction between common or ordinary love and a divine love. And this gets later refined by the next speaker, Eryximachus, who expands this divine love to encapsulate the whole universe. And then after this, it is Aristophanes' turn. Aristophanes is the renowned Greek comedian, and he tells a story about ball people who roll around and are two, but then Zeus splits them up, and this is the origin of love, is finding your other half.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, it's almost a, like, evolutionary account, a little bit. Like, this is how, like, the structure of love came into it. It's also, just for jumping in on the symposium, is probably one of the most well-known speeches, Aristophanes, just because it is so odd. And we're not going to get into too much, but discussing how we were, like you said, once we were all, like, we were one being, and then Zeus split us apart, and, you know, we rolled around with multiple, you know, like, four legs and four arms, and almost like some sort of psychedelic, like, cartoon character type thing.
It's a very comical picture that the comedian introduces. So we have Agathon's speech. Now we have the tragic, I should say that it isn't exactly tragic. The tragedian does not lean into any kind of narrative or story like Aristophanes chooses, but instead decides to open his speech by discussing rhetoric. And it's at this point that we have kind of decided to use Agathon's speech as a way into the way that rhetoric was understood and even used. He's evidently an award-winning playwright, and he knows how to use his tools, and he will be using them here. He explicitly opens up with an overt rhetorical move, commenting on the style of the previous speeches and the way that he will be going about conducting his own speech.
You know, like you said, Agathon was like quite a well-known poet at the time. You know, in 5th century Greece, and as you also mentioned, he's a really important character for the symposium as well, because as you kind of mentioned, he is representing rhetoric. He's representing a kind of potentially you might even get into a kind of sophistry. We'll talk a little bit about that and the kind of relationship between that and philosophy, and particularly with people like Socrates, and probably most importantly Plato, who's obviously writing the dialogue. But he's also like, there's a underlying like tacit recognition that rhetoric plays a really critical role in how people now, but especially back then, maybe even more now, but back then, communicated. Because he said, like, he just won a competition, so that's why we're even having this dinner, and it's set at his house, right? Like, it's his space, it's in his zone, it's in celebration of him, and he's, you know, the representative of rhetoric, right? So I think in some ways the setting is already making the point that rhetoric has a special, maybe not necessarily deserved, but a special position within this society.
Yeah, absolutely. It has a sort of, I don't think it would be going too far to even say a sort of privileged position within this, within especially Athenian society, where dramatic, and not just as a flippant term, but the dramatic institution is essentially bound up with their religious institutions. The Dionysia was considered one of the most sacred events and institutions within Athens. So this is a very important, if we are broaching the topic of something divine like love, eros, the rhetorician, the playwright, approaches the divine in this sort of way. I think, again, obviously, Plato is wanting to do something with this, and he will do that with his next speech, with Socrates' speech, when he talks about the approach towards the form of the beautiful. But he is toeing with this idea that there is something that the rhetorician is doing that is divine.
For this episode, we are actually going to read quite an extensive piece from the symposium, obviously Agathon's speech, and then we're going to discuss it a little bit and get a little bit more in depth and into the symposium and Agathon's, like, the structure. The reason we wanted to pick this was because it is a really good piece of, like, classic rhetoric with a lot of flourishing. And the reason I'll admit I was the first one to suggest this one, or this particularly Agathon speech, because when I finished the speech initially, I finished reading it section, and then I thought to myself, wow, that was really good. Like, that was a really impressive, well done little speech. And then it took me a little bit for it to kind of sink in and realize that, unlike what Socrates is going to come up to with the form of the beautiful and his later discussion, this was very much based around rhetorical flourishment, right? There's not a lot of really strong arguments. There's not a lot of, use of dialectic or reasoning. I mean, there's some, but it's not as heavy, but it is very well performed, or in our case, very well written. And I think for Plato, that's a recognition of Plato's own literary skill, because obviously he didn't actually have a transcript of Agathon's speech in all likelihood. Like, it's a pretty good chance Plato made a very large portion of this up to some degree. But it's also reflective that Plato wants you to be sucked in by rhetoric, or at least that is, displaying the power that it can have over the reader or the listener.
Yeah, absolutely. It speaks to, this is commented on often with Plato, that anytime we approach a given speaker, say in the Gorgias, where it's you're window shopping all of the sophists in Athens, and insofar as Plato approaches their style, he's writing this. He is mimicking their style, and so far as a writer has to be my mission, if that's an imitator, I think that's the actual word for that. Insofar as the writer has to be an imitator, it goes to show Plato's capacity to emulate a given writer's style, and that he can put on various voices, kind of like a playwright has to write different lines for different members of the cast. You're right. It goes to show a certain ability for Plato to be an imitator, but the fact that he is doing this, and in other works too, obviously, the fact that he's doing this in the service of a kind of reflexive critique or examination of imitation of rhetoric, it takes the writing from a display of capacity to a conscious use for philosophical ends.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's also I don't want to jump too much because we'll get into the reading in a couple minutes here, but I also think it shows Plato's this speech, but also other, you talk about Gorgias, who comes up, actually is brought up later as an example of a skilled rhetorician within the symposium he's brought up. But, a lot of this also, I think, has hints of Plato's acknowledgement and perhaps even some level of resentment of the fact that rhetoric was deeply tied up with political power at the time. And frankly, and here's the thing, it still is. That's an important point. But, maybe we can get into a little bit of Plato's own history and his relationship with political power. But, especially at this time, being able to convince the crowd, literally the crowd, it's not just a general populace, but literally everyone coming to see you speak. If you can get everyone riled up on your side, that is an enormously powerful tool. And there's some tacit acceptance from Plato, it seems, that there, maybe begrudgingly or concerningly, that sort of influence doesn't necessarily have to be in lockstep with the truth, right? And that's, obviously becomes a point of tension within the dialogue and in many other Platonic dialogues as well. So I'm going to read the speech now, and we'll take a few minutes, and then we'll discuss a little bit afterwards. We can certainly jump back into other points of interest within it. So again, for our listeners, just as a reminder, the speech is being given at the symposium. So as you can imagine, it's like a big dinner party, and there's speech after speech. This is kind of the entertainment of the night. It's like a different world, entertainment's just basically people giving talks. But this is Agathon's, it's Agathon's turn. So you can imagine a big kind of fancy ancient Romanesque dinner party. And Agathon gets up in front of everybody to give his speech on Eros, on the, effectively on the nature of love and the nature of the god of love. And for those of you who don't know, Eros is the Greek formation. The Romanized version is Cupid. So just in case people are generally more familiar with you know, Cupid, but there's some considerable differences in the mythology, but they are closely related. They're more or less the Romanized version is Cupid. So Agathon gets up and says, "I want first to talk about how I should talk and then talk. All the speakers so far have given me the impression that they were not so much praising the god as congratulating mankind on the good things the god provides. No one has told us what the giver of these benefits is really like in himself. And yet, in any speech of praise on any subject, the only correct procedure is to work systematically through the subject under discussion, saying what its nature is and what benefits it gives. That is how we too should by rights be praising Eros, describing first his nature, then his gifts. I claim then that though all the gods are blessed, Eros, if I may say this without offending the other gods, is the most blessed, since he is the most beautiful and the best. The most beautiful? Well, for a start, Phaedrus, he is the youngest of the gods. He proves this himself by running away at top speed from old age. Yet old age is swift enough and swifter than most of us would like. It is Eros's nature to hate old age and steer well clear of it. He lives and exists always with the young, birds of a feather, and all that. So though there was much in Phaedrus' speech with which I agreed, I didn't agree with his claim that Eros was older than Cronus or Iapetus. I would say he is the youngest of the gods, for he is eternally young, in fact. The earliest troubles among the gods, which Hesiod and Parmenides write about, were, if those writers are correct, the work of necessity, not Eros. If Eros had been there, there would have been none of this cutting or tying each other up or any other acts of violence. There would have been friendship and peace, as there has been since Eros became king of the gods. He is young, and not only young, but delicate. You need a poet like Homer to show how delicate. Homer describes eight as a god and as a delicate, or at any rate, with delicate feet. Delicate are her feet. She walks upon the ground, but goes upon the head. She walks not upon the ground, but goes upon the heads of men. Presumably, he's giving an example here to show how delicate she goes, not on what is hard, but on what is soft. We too can use similar argument to show how delicate Eros is. He does not walk upon the ground, nor yet on men's heads, which aren't that soft anyways. He lives and moves among the softest of all things, making his home in the hearts and minds of gods and men, and not in all hearts equally. He avoids any hard hearts he comes across, and settles among the tender-hearted. He must therefore be extremely delicate, since he only ever touches, either with his feet or in any other way, the softest of the soft. Very young then, and very delicate. Another thing about him is that he's very supple. He can't be rigid and unyielding, because he wouldn't be able to insinuate himself anywhere he likes, entering and leaving men's hearts undetected. Eros' outstanding beauty is universally agreed, and this again suggests he is well-proportioned and supple. Ugliness and Eros are ever at odds with one another. Finally, the beauty of his skin is attested by his love of flowers. He will not settle in a man's body or heart or anywhere else if it if it is past and first flower bloom, if it's past the first flower and bloom of youth. But he does settle down and remain in any flowering and fragrant place. So much for the god's beauty. Though I've left out one more, I've left out more than I've said. Now I must say something about his goodness. The main thing about Eros is that no one, god or man, wrongs him or is wronged by him. Nothing is done to him when it is done by force. Force cannot touch Eros. When he acts without force, since everyone serves Eros quite willingly. And it's agreed by our masters, the law, that where there is mutual consent and agreement, there is justice. Moreover, he is a paragon of virtue as well as justice. After all, virtue is agreed to be control of pleasures and desires, and no pleasure is stronger than love. But if they are weaker than love, then he has control over them. And if he has control over pleasures and desires, he must be highly virtuous. And what about courage? Ares himself cannot hold his ground against Eros. Ares does not take Eros prisoner. It is Eros, the love of Aphrodite, so the story goes, who takes Ares prisoner, and the captor is stronger than the captive. He who overcomes the bravest is himself the bravest of all. So much for God's justice, virtue, and courage. Now for his wisdom. I must try as hard as I can not to leave anything out. And so I too, in my turn, will start with a tribute to my own profession, following Areopagus's example. Eros is an accomplished poet. So accomplished he can turn others into poets. Everyone turns to poetry. However Philistine he may have been before, when moved by Eros. We should take this as an indication that, in general, Eros is master of all forms of literary or artistic creation. After all, no one can impart or teach a skill which he does not himself possess or know. And who will deny that the creation of all living things is the work of Eros' wisdom, which makes all living things come into being and grow? It's the same with any skilled activity. It is common knowledge that those who have this good for their teacher win fame and reputation. Those he passes by remain in obscurity. For example, Apollo's discoveries, archery, medicine, prophecy, were all guided by desire and love, so he too can be called a disciple of Eros. Likewise, with the muses and the arts, Hephaestus and metalworking, Athena and weaving, and Zeus, the governing of gods and men. And if we ask why the quarrels of gods were settled as soon as Eros appeared, without doubt the reason was love of beauty, there being no love of ugliness. In earlier times, as I said originally, there were many violent quarrels among the gods, or so we are told, because they were in the grip of necessity. But since Eros' birth, all manner of good has resulted, for gods and men all manner of good has resulted for gods and men from the love of beauty. Such, Phaedrus, is my view on Eros. He stands out as beautiful and excellent in himself. Secondly, he is the origin of similar qualities in others. I am tempted to speak in verse and say he brings sweet peace to men, and calm over all the deep. Rest to the winds, to those who sorrow and sleep. He gives us the feeling not of longing, but of belonging, since he is the moving spirit behind all the occasions when we meet and gather together. Festivals, dances, sacrifices, in these he is the moving spirit, implanter of gentleness, supplanter of fierceness, generous with his kindness, ungenerous with unkindness, gracious, gentle, an example to the wise, a delight to the gods, craved by those without him, saved by those who have him, of luxury, delicacy, elegance, charm, yearning, and desire. He is the father, heedful of the good, heedless of the bad, in hardship and in fear, in need and in argument. He is the best possible helmsman, comrade, ally, and savior, the glory of gods and men, the best and the finest guide, whom every man should follow, singing glorious praises to him, and sharing in the song which he sings to enchant the minds of gods and men. That is my speech, Phaedrus, in part fun, in part, as far as I could make it, fairly serious. Let it be an offering to the god. Some real praise there for Eros.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's see. After this, Plato relates the reaction. I won't go too far into it because we start getting into Socrates, his, you know, kind of ironic reaction. But when Agathon finished, Erasidamus said, everyone there burst into applause, so becoming to himself and to the god did they think the young man's speech. So they really, they burst into applause. I mean, it's a friendly drinking party where everyone is exchanging, you know, speeches, partly to entertain, partly really to praise the gods, which would have been, I mean, they're having fun with it, but this is a god we're praising here. So they do observe this as important. Everyone is getting applause, obviously, because it's a friendly environment, but that everyone bursts into applause. Not everyone has gotten this kind of applause yet. I mean, Socrates will go on to get the equivalent of an ancient Greek standing ovation, but Agathon's speech is well received. And apparently, when you finished reading this your first time over, you believed it was quite impressive as well, which this is exactly what we're going to start talking about.
And as I'm sure our listeners heard, hopefully my recitation of the speech was good enough to get the points through. It's a, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about rhetoric. It's obviously a very rhetorically flourished speech. And one thing that stands out is it performs the object of the under discussion. At least one of the objects under discussion within the context of the symposium was, you know, a praising of Eros, right? Earlier on in the dialogue, that's kind of like the point is we're going to talk a bit about like the nature of love, the nature of Eros, praising Eros, all that kind of stuff, right? So what it does very well is praises Eros. It is a very positively flourished discussion of Eros and why it's important and why it's impactful, and basically makes the argument that Eros, the god Eros, is far and away the most important being in the pantheon of gods and in the sort of impacted lives of men. And in that way, it's done very well in terms of that, you know, high degree of praise. But as we get into it, there's a lot of claims. There's a lot of claiming going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I should say, too, the claims themselves. First of all, that there are claims is quite interesting when you are praising someone, right? I mean, if you are praising Eros, it should be, and again, maybe I'm just getting into what Agathon is talking about, it should be apparent about what it is that you're praising. And indeed, this is exactly how Agathon opens his speech, is by saying, look, we have been talking about Eros. Let's get serious. Let's actually praise Eros. And that means enumerating qualities, right? And then at that point, he starts enumerating qualities of Eros as gentle, supple, handsome. We're talking about a god here specifically. And it will be from these qualities that Eros is beautiful.